Session number 6184, Reel 2.
Mr. Woodhouse, tape 2.
Had a bicycle chain coiled up under his foot in his boot. Another one had a two-speed hub in his large drinking mug taped to pieces. And one had several inner tubes of, for bicycles around his waist. And having taken these round to the canteen and got rid of them quite successfully to the Chinese, they bought a lot of food and brought it back. And they left a lot in the tins on the table. And they said, well, that's your share. And I said, well, I've no money to pay you. And they said, well, go on, eat it. Your turn will come. And I did, rather gladly, actually. And this was the pattern of things. They're three fine chaps, those Aussies. Not because they gave me food, but because they were just good men. Eventually, I got to the stage where I did start to earn money. And this was really by... it was on cosmetics. One took an awful risk on this. The Japanese really took a very serious view about stealing. And if you were caught with it, really, the least you could expect was a terrible beating up, and a very severe one. But one did this, I think, to restore one's self-respect to some extent. You were hitting back at them in some way, trying to outthink them. And in many cases, it wasn't difficult. I made quite a bit of money with lipsticks I got from one of the go-downs. And quite a bit of money, which was very lucky at the time because it did keep body and soul together, even later on when we moved up country onto the railway, John.
What was the actual bartering process, having had you go about it?
It's very simple. This so-called Chinese canteen consisted of one long table, right, as I say, under the eyes of the Japanese garden, where the Japs were all sitting, looking very pompous. And it was covered with a tablecloth, which hung down nearly to ground level each side. And the table, of course, was loaded with the goods they had to sell you. But underneath the table, concealed by the cloth, was a little Chinese boy. And if you went round there with a haversack loose on your shoulder, something in it, and you nodded to the China on the other side of the table, you'd feel the haversack taken from your shoulder by the little boy under the table. You'd stand there for a while, the haversack would be put back with the money in it. You bartered across the table in terms of amount and that sort of thing. But they were very honest, the Chinese, in this sense. They wanted things, they couldn't get them. And they, in turn, of course, sold these things in Singapore to people who wanted them, probably on the black market.
Did you ever get into trouble doing that?
No, not really. I was very lucky. I had one very good escape, actually. I was very nearly searched, but the chaps in the section managed to start a bit of a diversion, which distracted the Japs' attention. We swapped over haversacks. They'd already been searched and I hadn't. Got me by with it rather nicely. But I did share out what I got.
Can you talk about the time when the Japanese officer was giving you a sort of pantomime about stealing
bully beef? Yes, that was a classic. You see, when we went out to work, indeed in the docks, indeed anywhere, we'd be given a mess tin full of a ration of rice in a mess tin, which went cold, of course, by lunchtime. And with it, some gosai, as the Japanese called it, which was a flavouring agent. In the Japanese case, it would be fish or meat. In our case, it was what might be stew, a loose term for sort of juice of a marrow between about 50 men or something of that sort. So the first thing we looked for in arriving in the docks was a warehouse of food, whatever you could steal it. It could be bully beef, it could be a tin of herrings, it could be a jar of tongue, anything really which would make something of a meal of a midday break. And the Japs didn't like this at all. They knew it was going on. And one morning, this little Jap chap we had, looked like a little beetle actually, he went to an elaborate ritual, as most Japanese did, to make a speech. He got on a box and stood in front of us. And the substance of what he was saying was that he knew that the English haitai, that is, English soldier, was stealing Nippon haitai, Nippon soldiers' food, and it was bad, and everybody would get a bamboo presento, which meant a whack with a bamboo stick or a rifle butt or something of that sort. And he went on to say that in broken sort of English, come Malay, come Japanese, he knew how this was done. And he was absolutely right, in fact. He borrowed an Australian hat, which was the wide-brimmed affair, and got a small tin of bully under his hat, held it under his arm against his body, went round behind the shed outside which he was then talking, and put the hat down, and came back and said, "That how you steal Japanese food?" We didn't confirm or deny, of course, but when he went back to pick the hat up, that tin had gone as well. One of the Aussies had had it. Now, we all got a whack with a bamboo stick, but we shared the bully bits beef between us at lunchtime. We got away with that one anyway.
How often did beatings up and beatings in general take
place? It varied. Sometimes they became very, very, very much worse. You see, we were the lowest rung of the ladder at that time, and since in the Japanese army the system was, and may still be for all I know, that there's no sort of discipline or punishments for indiscipline as we know it in this country. If somebody had done something like it, he would be beaten up on the spot by his immediate superior. Pardon me, I suppose it became quite natural for the Japanese to pass that treatment on to us. But the only thing was that we were really at the mercy of the lowest private in the Japanese army. And certainly the Koreans who came along later, and they were worse to us than the Japanese in a way.
You hadn't yet encountered the Koreans?
Not at that time, no, no. These were Japanese, but they were pretty low lot. Pretty low lot. And they were sadistic, a lot of them. So some were all right. But if a man came looking for trouble, he could always find it. I mean, if you didn't see him to salute him, you were supposed to salute or bow to all Japanese soldiers. Or they could always find something and give you a hell of a beating. I mean, they worked themselves up to a frenzy once they started. The thing was, you had to stand on your feet all the time you could. If you're on the ground, they'd start with their boots, and the outcome of that was you could be killed, really. You had no appeal against it. That was the point. They had the power of life and death over you.
Were any of the guards friendly to you?
We came across one or two who seemed better disposed than others. I didn't come across very much, so I say, fraternisation, for lack of a better term, until a good deal later. And that was on the railway job, of course, but we got on with some better than others. Some set out to cause trouble, others we could tolerate, and some were even trying to learn English at that time. I should never forget one Japanese sitting with a group of Norfolks who was trying to learn English, and they're teaching him to count. And these chaps were typical Norfolk men. They were going with a sort of Norfolk accent. And the Japanese were learning to count. And as I passed them, he was saying 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And it struck me then that years hence, if any of that man ever learns English, people can say, why his tutor was a Norfolk man. I shall never know.
It was here that one of the Australians was caught smuggling bike oil, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. He, not one of my immediate friends, I may add, but he was pinching some bicycle oil in his water bottle. The thing about a water bottle was, if you wanted to conceal something, you had to make sure you had some water in the top of it. You had to have a false bottom. In fact, I think there are two or three wireless sets later on in the bottom of water bottles. But this Aussie had filled his water bottle up with bike oil, and a Japanese got thirsty later, got out of the bottle and could sweat. I realised it was bicycle oil.
So there was a fairly thriving black economy.
Yes. As I say, one did this to restore a certain amount of self-respect. Independent-minded people from democracies, you don't readily take to the sort of dictatorship these people are imposing. You have to do something about them.
And you sold a tin of condensed milk to a Japanese guard as well?
I did, yes. I had no idea, really. I had a tin of condensed milk in my kit. And I didn't really like condensed milk. It was the rather crude type. It wasn't even full cream milk. But it was the sticky stuff. And I was looking at it one day and a Jap came past. Now, I should explain here that we firmly believe this Japanese was suffering from venereal disease, because a lot of them were. And since at that time, anyway, it was a crime in the Japanese army to catch it rather than to conceal it, they were always looking for quack remedies. And this man was no exception. And he asked me what the milk was, and I suddenly got a rather brilliant idea, I think, which still amuses me when I think about it. I told him it was a pretty good certain cure for VD if it was rubbed in externally. And he wanted me to present to him. I said, oh no, this $50. He went away and got his $50, and he gave it, and I gave him the tin of milk. And really, for a long time after that, and even now, whatever I think about the Japanese, I can still laugh about it. The idea of that fellow applying condensed milk to his private parts in the belief it cured VD struck me as too funny for words, really. Luckily, I moved out of camp the next day. So.
How was the health of the prisoner of war prisoners of war holding up at that stage?
At that time, it wasn't too bad. We could still get food from these canteen sources. And at that time, the Japanese food hadn't become quite so bad as it was later on. It wasn't until later when malaria, dysentery, various other things, certainly cholera and other things began to take their toll, that the avitaminosis diseases began to make themselves felt, septic sores and ulcers and this sort of thing.
Did you do any other work apart from working on the docks?
We were... Also, you never knew quite what you were going to do. We were taken on one occasion to a large paper works, a printing works, to clear that out. It was an awful mess. It had been bombed and a lot of paper lying about. It had been flooded. And then we went loading tin plate in Malaya itself across the causeway to a pineapple factory, loading those things and taking the turn freight. It wasn't too bad.
You built a barracks as well, didn't you?
Oh, yes. We had to build some new... Well, we were helping to build some new huts for Japanese troops who were coming into Singapore. They were nice modern places, but we took the opportunity of infesting them with bugs because our own quarters were running alive with them. We couldn't really... One of the worst things about, I suppose, any prison camp where one can't keep clean is the amount of personal vermin. There's something very degrading about fleas and bugs and lice, and try as you might, you can't ultimately keep them down. And we saw no reason why the Japanese shouldn't suffer as we were, so we used to collect matchboxes full of bugs and release them in this place as we were working. And of course, they soon got a hold. And it wasn't a few days after the Japanese had been in there, we could see them shaking their clothes out and scratching themselves and saying, Nenki mushtak san damiso. They didn't like bugs any more than we did. They were red with bites all over these damn things.
How much money did you manage to amass during your time there?
Oh, several thousand dollars, but a lot of it went, of course, in food.
How much money had most people managed to...
Most people made something. It varied in amounts. We all kept fairly quiet about this for obvious reasons. Had it become generally known that we were doing this and somebody had been taken aside and asked, we could all have been in there. It's a bit like the radio sets that came along later. The less people knew about it, the better. You couldn't really afford to have that knowledge disseminated through the entire camp.
Where did you keep your money?
I kept a lot of mine in largish notes behind a photograph of my wife in a sort of picture frame.
That was a safe place, wasn't it?
It was, because as soon as a Japanese sentry looked at you, they'd say, oh, why for? And you'd say yes. And then you could sidetrack him by saying, I four children. For the Japanese, for some reason, seem to respect a man who can produce a number of children. Although there's no photograph of them, they didn't say fortune, start talking about wife, and that would, to a very large extent. We never came across at that stage the Kempe, or Kempeitai, the Japanese police. They might have been more difficult. We encounter some later on, but not in that sense.
Did you have guards of other nationalities at that stage? I think you said you had Sikhs.
Had some Sikhs who'd gone over to the Japanese in Free Indian Army. I think in the belief, or in response to promises of a lot of money and the greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere, which only ever prospered the Japanese, and then temporarily, I suppose. Certainly the civilian population in these countries did very badly out of it.
How did they conduct themselves towards you?
The Sikhs were, Free Indian Army, were very objectionable. Very objectionable. They were again in the position of somebody who's acquired a sudden mastery over somebody they've hitherto served, and it wasn't very nice at all.
Were you given any lectures or talks on your new status or on being a POW?
Well, we gathered very early on the Japanese despised us for surrendering, because they never do surrender, apparently. It's a different concept entirely. But, and one doesn't doubt, I mean, I respect the Japanese for their fighting quality, very, very hard, durable little men, and I can understand the difference in view. But the fact was that the surrender of Singapore was as much due, I think, to considerations civilian populations as anything else. An army's there to fight, and had we been told to fight to the last man, we probably would have had to do so. But bearing in mind that the population of Singapore had been swollen beyond belief, really, by refugees from the mainland, the place is being bombed every day fairly heavily by 27 bombers at a time. And most of the water was controlled by the Japanese. If they'd cut that off, pestilence would have seen thousands and thousands of people off.
Did you get any talks from British officers about...
Occasionally, we were given talks upon morale keeping, which was necessary. Morale hadn't suffered much at that time. It seemed that the closing of ranks with the capitulation, we were determined that we'd seem to hang together. Without any exhortation, I should add, too. We did early on have a lecture from a senior British officer who was very factual about this, and he'd thought about it, thinking back, and he didn't deserve the sort of barracking and the booing he got. But what he said to us was that he asked us to dismiss any rumours we might hear about early release, because in his view, it would be a long time. It would be at least 3 years before we could hope for any release. And if the war in the Middle East went against it, it could be considerably longer. And this was considered so opposed to our ideas, quite opposed to any ideas of how the Allies might react, that we booed him. And I think it was quite wrong, because he was absolutely right. He told us at that time that the chief concern, of course, was Germany, which undoubtedly was right. That had to be done. And that had to be done first in the bridge. And then, and only then really, could the Allies, by this time of course America was in the war following Pearl Harbor, devote their full resources and energies toward the war in the Far East.
Had you had a chance to let your relatives know that you were alive?
We were given cards by the Japanese, which were sort of pro forma. You had to cross certain words out or leave certain words in and sign it. You weren't allowed to add anything. I still have one of the cards with me here, which I was lucky in this sense. We had, all in all, from our period of captivity, about six of these given to us. And most of mine got home, although a number of chaps I know never got word home to their people at all, parents or wives. I was lucky in this sense that my first card got home. And one letter I received late on in the war from my wife acknowledged that one card. So I was lucky that I knew they knew I was right up to that time anyway. And I knew they were. It was really a question of playing out time and surviving as far as I was concerned at that time. And I became determined to survive, by hook or by crook.
Did you get much news about the general state of the war?
Not early on. It took a little time for the radio bus to make their little radio sets, which they did surprisingly well later on. A number of sets were in operation. Most ingenious things, the way they were concealed. But the difficulty was one had to be very careful how this news was disseminated. If good news had leaked out quickly to all the camp, the difference in attitude to all the Japanese would have been so marked that even they would have noticed it. So one had to be very, very careful indeed. And the penalty, really, for working, owning, or knowing where a wireless set was frightful.
When were you moved on?
We were moved on when parties started to be taken, just after parties were taken up from Singapore to Thailand. We knew subsequently, of course, it was to build this railway. But we didn't. Rumours at that time embraced that such things as roads, a canal across the Kra Isthmus, which would have been quite reasonable from the Japanese point of view to get to the Indian Ocean and could do more quickly. But there was obviously some major work going on up north in Malaya, and ours was going to be the labour that was going to do it. It was quite obvious.
What did you volunteer for this work, or were
no.
you collected?
No, you were just taken. You were just detailed. I was lucky in one sense, again, I suppose, that the parties that went up earlier, of course, were concerned with jungle clearing, building embankments, digging cuttings, building bridges and sort of things around rock faces, which looked perilous in the extreme. And the idea, I think, from the Japanese was to support their army in Burma with reinforcements and war material, on a one-track railway, which struck me as nonsensical.
What did you think it would be like before you went up there?
We had no idea. At that time, we reached a stage almost of apathy as far as the Japanese was concerned. They were making promises, of course, it would be a nice camp, plenty of food, as they always did when we moved, but we had grave misgivings about it. And although it wasn't too bad when we first arrived, it grew considerably worse as we moved up country.
What's the train like that you went up on?
It was a train, really, of rice trucks. These one sees them in Great Refuge, see them, I suppose, in England, really, and in Europe. It's a solid truck with a sliding door in the middle each side, which was used to transport mainly rice or sacks of stuff. But we were put, I think, just 32 men to one of these trucks, which meant, of course, that you couldn't really lie down, all of you, or sit down. You had to have some standing, some lying, and some crouching. And you had to take turns, really, to lie down and get any comfort at all. And that took us up to, it was a journey, quite a long journey, really, from Singapore right up to Ban Pong, a place called Ban Pong in Thailand.
Was there any sanitation on the train?
No, one had to wait till the train stopped or do one's best while the train was moving.
Was the journey interrupted at all?
It was interrupted for food. We'd stop at stations for food to be issued. It was interrupted at one stage for several days when the track, I think, had been washed away further up the line. We were simply unloaded into the edge of a banana grove and told to stay there until such time as the train could proceed, some of us being used to repair the line further up before we could go. There were several days, about a week or more there.
What was the food like you were getting on the train?
The same, really, as the... In some cases, it was better. I can remember at Kuala Lumpur, where we stopped there, it was quite a good meal because the Chinese cooks were there and they cooked some nice rice and some bean sprouts and that, so it was very, very nice. But it got worse as one went further up. You could always buy, of course, from Thai vendors, because as soon as the train stopped, these little boys and women would be around the train trying to sell us things. Or, indeed, to buy things from us. If we had items of clothing or boots which they wanted, they'd buy from us. It was strictly forbidden by the Japanese to do so. But when a man gets hungry, you can't really stop him selling things like that.
So men sold, what, their boots and blankets?
Oh, yes, right? Yes. Mm. They subsequently regretted, and I add, it was a foolish decision to make.
So how long did the journey take altogether?
Crikey. I suppose, but taking that halt into account, it probably took... I think... about a fortnight, I think. Maybe longer.
What were your spirits like on the train?
They were getting a bit low then. It was... we couldn't see where we were going at... it was hot. During the day, the temperature in these metal trucks rose alarmingly, and at night time it got damn cold because there was no heat. But there were enough of us there at night, of course, to huddle together and keep some semblance of warmth up. The trouble was you couldn't stretch out. I think the most comfortable night's sleep I had, we stopped at one station, a halt one night, and we simply got out of the truck and lay down on the platform. We had no pillows, really, no blankets, but the sheer luxury of stretching out to full length, we slept like logs all night then.
What was Ban Pong like when you arrived?
A typical Thai village with these rather broken down attap huts which are formed of a sort of reed which forms a more or less waterproof roof. Indeed, if it's properly done, it can be a completely waterproof roof. You see these in illustrations all over the place. And attap walls and built of bamboo. They're very quickly built and they can be quite good. But these were already collapsing and half the ground was flooded anyway. It's rather depressing. And that's where we started building this railway. At least our contribution to it was actually laying the rails and the sleepers and so on.
What was people's reaction when they saw these broken down attap huts?
Well, in British Army language, I couldn't really repeat on a tape. They cast doubt upon the legitimacy of the Japanese who'd ordered us to go up there. But I think in the British Army, indeed any army, I suppose, really, if it has any morale or character at all, you sort of rally around. And the British Army, I think, is probably better than it. You have a sense of humour rising above it. I'm rather pleased about it.
Did you get time to repair the huts?
No, we didn't. We weren't there long enough to start off with, and secondly, they started work on this railway for us, and we very soon moved out of it to the next camp up the line, which is a good deal better.
What sort of work were you doing?
We were actually laying the rails. It was a primitive business. If one talks about laying a railway now, one envisages all sorts of sophisticated equipment and so on. But here, of course, they were going through what had been virgin country. It was badly rough. And all they had really were plenty of rails and plenty of sleepers. In fact, a lot of the sleepers were made on the spot by Thai workers out of teak, and because they were too hard for sleepers really. The thing was, the system was, the Japanese had a series of little trucks or little bogies, four-wheeled bogies. On each of these bogies, and hinged in the middle, was a very, very strong bar which could turn. And by dint of laying 10 rails between two of these trucks, they joined them up into one long truck, in effect, with the rails forming the body of the truck. At each end, of course, on the small bogie was a tiny platform on which stood a so-called brake man to screw a brake down. On top of the rails were piled enough sleepers to deal with a number of rails. And on top of the rails again and sleepers were the chaps who were going to work on the railway. It was essential, of course, to get these. These couldn't be drawn or pulled up the line, because when they got to the other end, you had an engine to get out of the way. What the Japanese did was have an army lorry which was fitted with railway wheels at the back. It would push these things in front of as much as a dozen trucks at a time, which would be pushed up until it reached the last rail that had been laid. And then the sleepers on the first truck would be taken off, one man, one sleeper, laid roughly ahead, put into better position by two other chaps, roughly distanced. And then the first rail would be shoved off over the two bodies of the two bogies to fall on the rails, be straightened up by a party, joined to the previous rail by fish plates and a few dog spikes knocked in to hold it to the other sleepers. And then, of course, the truck would move on. You'd have to take those two little trolleys off the line with an instrument the Japanese called a gazinka, for some reason. And the next truck would go up, so to speak, and the process would repeat until they'd all been done, and then the little trolleys would be put back and they'd been drawn back to the base, and another train would come up. It's a simple process, quite primitive and quite effective. And for the first few weeks it wasn't too bad. We were working on flat country. The number of trucks to be laid each day was quite small, and we were getting through very rapidly. In fact, we got a drill on this, and it wasn't unpleasant work.
So there are a number of different gangs doing...
Oh, yes, you had... there was a certain pride in this. I mean, chaps who carried sleepers became inured to it. Those that wielded the little hammers and knocked the dog spikes in became inured to that too. And one could become surprisingly accurate, those little 7-pound hammers. I had to go at that for a time. And there's little doubt that had we received enough decent food for it, we'd have become remarkably fit. But we didn't. This was the point. When I said it, the work wasn't too bad, it's as pleasant as any work can be, which one has to do for, what shall I say, for an enemy during wartime.
What sort of hours were you working?
At that time, quite light. As long as we got through the number of trucks a day, the Japs didn't care. We went back to our camp. Then they realised, of course, we were getting through the work quickly. It was our fault, really. And they started to add to the load.
How long would you spend in a camp before moving on to the next
It time? Just depended.